Today we present a conversation on the 20th century economist John Maynard Keynes, who opposed revolutions and social upheaval, who at the same time was very much in favor of improving the material and intellectual conditions of everyday people. In fact, he saw social unrest as a byproduct of inequality. So to have one meant that you got the other. He saw economics as a tool. In fact, he saw money as a tool that could bring the good things of life enjoyed by the aristocracy to be equally enjoyed by the common person. Now, it would be easy today to see Keynes as just another dreamer with his head in the clouds, far from reality. But John Maynard Keynes was the intellectual architect of the New Deal that would carry the United States out of the Great Depression and lead to a certain level of prosperity for most parts of society. For this conversation, we are joined by Zachary D. Carter. Zachary D. Carter is a journalist who specializes on economics, and he is the author of a biography called The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Zachary D. Carter, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this program.
Thanks so much for having me, Mitch.
To begin with, and before we get heavily into the ideas, just for a starting point, give me a quick biography or what people should know about John Maynard Keynes.
Well, let me start with where I learned about John Maynard Keynes and what I first learned about him. And that was from an Econ 101 course as an undergraduate in the very early years of the 21st century, where I was told that Keynes was the guy who came up with the idea for counter-cyclical government spending, for the idea that governments should spend money during recessions in order to lift the economy sort of out of the doldrums and bring back economic growth. That is undoubtedly a significant part of his legacy as an intellectual. But as I was conducting the research for this book, it just became very clear to me that this was sort of an accident that this is what he was remembered for. In most of his life, he was really more of a social thinker or what we might call a philosopher today than an economist. It's just that through the discipline of economics, his legacy has sustained itself. And so in a lot of ways, the common sense perception of who Keynes is has been written by the economics profession rather than by, say, you know, the philosophy discipline or by social theorists. And there's an awful lot going on in there. Keynes never really wanted to be remembered as a kind of deficit therapist. He was concerned with the great problems of his day, which were war and peace and international harmony. And he spent his life trying to use economic policy to treat those big social problems, because he was, for the most part, a pacifist thinker, someone who was very opposed to the use of violence to solve problems. And he thought through economic policymaking, he could, he and the other sort of elites of his day could manage a world that was beyond war and conflict.
John Maynard Keynes is often linked to New Deal policies during the Great Depression. How accurate is it to call what FDR did in the 1930s and 1940s Keynesian?
I think it's very accurate, but as with everything, accurate with caveats. Keynes had adopted his policy sort of prescription for the Great Depression several years before he wrote his magnum opus, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, which was used to sort of justify those policies intellectually. That book came out in 1936. Keynes had been advocating for massive deficit spending proposals at least as early as 1929. He was a very great admirer of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, just thought the world of him, wrote some really frankly, beautiful character sketches of him in these memos that he sent back to London when he was a diplomat during World War II and was meeting with Roosevelt. Roosevelt never really liked Keynes, though. The admiration was not mutual. Keynes was he thought Keynes was a little bit too head in the clouds. He also thought that he never really forgave Keynes for a very scathing indictment of Woodrow Wilson, and that he wrote in 1919 in a very famous book called The Economic Consequences of the Peace. And Woodrow Wilson was at the time, somebody who FDR admired. He was a Democrat like FDR himself. And so there was always sort of a skepticism from Roosevelt towards Keynes himself. But within his administration, there were a series of economists who were hired very early on, who thought very highly of Keynes, even before the general theory was written, and who would tell him, look, these are the types of policies we need to be pursuing, and would point to Keynesian economists, people who were influenced by the general theory, and say, this explains why this policy worked and why this year was very bad. So there's a sort of double dip recession in 1937 when the economy goes, after several years of extraordinary growth, just goes off a cliff all of a sudden. And a bunch of Roosevelt's advisors are able to say, here's what went wrong and here's what you should do. So the policies that Roosevelt was adopting were Keynesian, but the influence was indirect. And in many ways, the theory that ultimately justified them hadn't been written yet. Keynes was the most prominent and respected figure advocating for these types of proposals, but he didn't have the big sort of grand theoretical apparatus in place yet. I think it's really important for them to be linked together, but it's also important to recognize that Keynes didn't stop doing economic work during the New Deal. His legacy as a policymaker in Britain, for instance, is very different, and I think in a lot of ways much more significant. He was the financial architect of the Beveridge Plan, which includes the National Health Service and the socialization of British medicine. So Keynes kept working after the New Deal, and much of his intellectual legacy and the way we should understand this sort of deficit ideas that he had during the New Deal, we should understand in the context of this broader legacy that he developed after Roosevelt left office.
What are the ideas of Keynes, do you think, that have been lost since his death up to today?
Keynes cared very much about the Enlightenment and the tradition of Enlightenment liberalism. So he was deeply committed to these ideas about individual liberty and personal freedom that he saw expressed by what today I think we would consider a fairly diverse array of thinkers, people that include Edmund Burke and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. These are the sort of great men of European philosophy history that at least when I was in school, you would be taught in sort of a philosophy, political philosophy 101 class. But he recognized that there were a lot of different ideas that were going on in these thinkers. He saw Burke as somebody who was committed to social stability. He saw somebody like John Locke as committed to the property rights of the wealthy. And he saw Rousseau as somebody who was committed to a sort of radical egalitarianism, a social equality. I think there's a great deal of social scholarship which says that, these people have complicated legacies, but this was the way that Keynes looked at it. You take in colonialism and all the rest, and, there's a lot to talk about with any of these thinkers, but Keynes felt like this tradition had really hung together because it had united around a common set of economic policy proposals, that these ideas didn't really hang together unless you agreed on a set of economic policies that actually sort of delivered the goods, that actually worked for these different philosophical kind of beliefs. And he thought that economic policy idea was the gold standard and the laissez-faire system that existed between the 1870s and World War I, basically, but that system, if it ever had worked, certainly wasn't working in the years after World War I. And he thought that Enlightenment liberalism was going to collapse if they could not come up with a set of economic policies which would allow these different traditions to sort of come into harmony. Keynes was ultimately somebody who was, like Burke, very afraid of revolution and social upheaval, but who was deeply committed to the egalitarian ethos that we can see in Rousseau's writings. And so he sort of used an argument in favor of social stability to advance what were fairly radical policy proposals. He wanted people to be able to participate in the type of life that he lived in Bloomsbury's, the London district of Bloomsbury in the early 20th century. This was a period of really intense intellectual and artistic flourishing for Bloomsbury. These are people like Virginia Woolf and E.M. Forster. There are some great painters like Duncan Grant who are going to visit Gertrude Stein and Pablo Picasso in Paris. They're part of this intellectual and artistic milieu where these artists really believe that through the power of art and ideas, they can break down the international barriers between people. So they can heal a world in conflict just by making art and writing novels. In a lot of ways, this is a very naive perspective, but it's also a really great way of life. You know, you're getting your hair cut by Virginia Woolf's sister and drinking champagne with Virginia Woolf and talking about her friends meeting with Picasso. That's a pretty great afternoon. And Keynes thought that this was something that did not have to be exclusive to the British upper class. This was something that could be enjoyed by everybody, and that you were much more likely to avoid situations like much like what we're seeing now in the United States, right, where there are people in the streets almost every night protesting what is essentially inequality, inequality manifested through violence. And he would have said, you know, the point of economic policy is to create this certain sort of life and this certain sort of society. It is not to tell people that there are certain things we just can't afford. It's to find a way to make that way of living affordable.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation about the life and theories of 20th century economist John Maynard Keynes. Our guest is Zachary D. Carter. Zachary D. Carter is a senior reporter at the Huffington Post. He covers Congress, the White House, and economic policy. He is the author of a new biography called The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Zach Carter, let's go back in time now, and let's go to 1914, the beginning of World War I. John Maynard Keynes is with the British Treasury Department during this period of time. You brought up his relationship and his interaction with the Bloomsbury Group. World War I would create stressors within that group, between him and other members of this group. Talk to me about the importance of World War I and John Maynard Keynes.
World War I is really sort of the cauldron in which Keynes's genius is cooked. He spends a great deal of his early life being largely content. I mean, what's wrong with drinking champagne with Virginia Woolf and talking about Pablo Picasso's latest work? That seems pretty great. But World War I really, really shook his belief in progress and in the benevolence of the British Empire as a sort of incubator of democracy and prosperity, not only because the war itself was so violent and terrible, but because he was able to see firsthand how decisions were made within the British cabinet. He became very quickly the head of British war finance, even though he was relatively young at the time. He was 31 when the war broke out. And he said later, you know, all of the money that we spent on this war passed through my hands in some form or another. And it's maybe a slight exaggeration, but it's close to the truth. He was not popular in Bloomsbury for having this position. Everybody else in Bloomsbury was opposed to the war. All of his friends, whether they were philosophers like Bertrand Russell or writers like Virginia Woolf, thought the war was just this monstrous example of brutal European imperialism, where people were sending young men off to die over, you know, silly things like territory. So they came to some pretty serious – the social conflict between them was very serious. And Keynes ultimately, I think, came to agree with his friends who were critics of his work. And so his first really important book of economic theory, of social theory, is a book called The Economic Consequences of the Peace, which he publishes in 1919. And it documents what he saw going wrong at the negotiations over the treaty that ended the war. He saw the treaty, you know, after 4 years of this horrible conflict, he thought, okay, well, here's my chance to redeem myself. I can go and help make a peace treaty that puts Europe on a path towards stability and harmony and mutual prosperity, mutual respect. And instead, the treaty he thought was just a total disaster. It assigned these very high reparations duties to Germany as sort of a punishment for starting the war. And the United States did not relieve its allies of these enormous debts that they had accumulated over the course of the war to spend on, you know, arms and munitions. He believed that this was ultimately going to lead not only to, you know, problems with economic growth, but to international enmity, that as people saw that their own economic conditions were not improving, and they also saw their governments were shipping all of this capital overseas to foreign creditors, that this was going to breed resentment, that there would be future conflicts, and there would be conflicts both domestic and foreign, that people wouldn't stand for their own governments doing this sort of thing, and they wouldn't feel very good about the people who were taking their money. And he believed that it would be difficult to blame them for feeling that way. So he's terribly depressed by what happens at Paris, and he writes this absolutely scathing book called The Economic Consequences of the Peace. And it's a smash hit. It's kind of a surprise smash hit, particularly in the United States. It sells over 100,000 copies, which, you know, for a book called The Economic Consequences of the Peace, it's pretty good. His previous book, I think, had sold 970 copies.
Well, also had a great name, too, the first book. It was about India.
The first book, Indian Currency and Finance. Yeah. These are very technical terms for these books, because he thinks he's going to be reaching an audience of fancy financial patricians. He doesn't think he's writing for the public more broadly. And in the case of The Economic Consequences of the Peace, he's just totally wrong. And it's easy to see why. You read that book, it doesn't really read like you would expect a book called The Economic Consequences of the Peace to read. It reads like a work of modernism. It has these just incredible character sketches of Woodrow Wilson and Georges Clemenceau and Lloyd George, who are, you know, the major figures negotiating the treaty. His writing has an incredible emotional power. T.S. Eliot, actually, when he wrote The Wasteland, you know, his one of T.S. Eliot's masterpieces, in many ways, The Wasteland was an attempt to do a sort of free verse re-rendering of what Keynes did in The Economic Consequences of the Peace. So he had this influence on people well outside the economics profession very early. But in a lot of ways, it's because the book was an attempt to sort of confess to Bloomsbury that Keynes was wrong about the war, that they had been right, and that henceforth he wasn't going to let his ego.
What was he wrong about? What was he confessing he was wrong about the war?
He was saying that that the war had not been an opportunity to bring peace and prosperity to the rest of the world, to defend democracy from the march of autocracy. Keynes doesn't get involved in the war because he thinks he's doing a great act of human freedom. He gets involved in the war because it's an excellent career opportunity for him. He's an obscure academic, and here he is with this enormously serious position in the halls of power. But he becomes very enamored with the vision of the war that Woodrow Wilson puts forward when the United States gets involved, which is that these are the democracies of the world defending themselves against autocracy, and they are going to create a peace treaty and a lasting peace that is going to make sure that democracy is possible wherever it is possible all over the world. And he thinks that the peace treaty that is actually signed is a totally offensive document that doesn't live up to that ideal. And so he's basically telling Bloomsbury, you know, you guys were right. This war was pointless. We accomplished nothing. And I'm sorry. A lot of the fury that he directs against Clemenceau and against David Lloyd George and against Woodrow Wilson in that book is really, I think, a projection of his own disappointment in himself for for playing along with this game. He feels like he was betrayed by these people in a certain sense, but he also feels like he betrayed himself because his friends, of course, were telling him all along, what are you doing? Please resign from the Treasury.
Is it fair to say that he predicted something like the rise of fascism throughout Europe?
I absolutely. The arguments that he's putting forward in this book are that they're very Burkean in a real sense. You know, the argument that Edmund Burke made against the French Revolution, you know, which is it again from the later stages of the French Revolution, so not the super early idealistic phases, but. Burke is basically arguing that you're going to set up a dictator. You are going to break down these social bonds between people, and as a result, the only thing that will be able to restore order will be some sort of they didn't have a word like fascism in the 1790s when Burke was writing, but some sort of authoritarian power, and that's essentially what Keynes is saying about the Treaty of Versailles. And it happens very quickly. You know, there are political assassinations happening in Germany in the early 1920s. Benito Mussolini is in power very quickly as well. And you have the beer hall putsch from Hitler by 1924 in Germany. So the rise of authoritarianism is very clear. And people who are not sort of on the left, what we would call the left today, can see it coming too. You know, at the treaty, there was a guy named Herbert Hoover who had been in charge of the food relief program that the United States had been doing, largely successful program that saved hundreds of thousands of lives. Herbert Hoover says, you know, you can see these revolutions happening all over Europe right now. He's mostly afraid of the Bolshevik Revolution. So he's afraid of sort of a left-wing authoritarian power coming. But he thinks that if they cannot provide economic aid to Europe, that there will be some sort of authoritarian power that rises. Keynes is more frightened of a right-wing authoritarian power. But that idea is out there in the ether. And I think Keynes distilled it in a way that that is incredibly powerful, and is the reason he becomes such a revered figure intellectually in the years to come, because he loses his battles at the Treaty of Versailles at Paris in 1919. And then he loses almost every policy battle that he fights in Britain, certainly between 1919 and World War II. And so somebody who just keeps being overruled over and over again, it's hard for that person to maintain a public persona, but the events of the time appear to keep vindicating what he is, what he had said in the economic consequences of the peace, which was an argument that he kept going for years afterwards. You know, he just said, you know, if we don't fix this, we are asking for dictatorship and war. And that was, you know, I think it's just hard to argue that he was wrong about that. I mean, we see what happened. And we see also the way that, that in Germany in particular, the way the German far right argued about what was happening, they would use reparations in the treaty as a cudgel to advance other goals that were, you know, not at first it wasn't the Holocaust, but these far right ideas that ended up that culminated in the Holocaust. So I have a hard time seeing how Keynes was anything but prescient about this. The book has its flaws, to be clear. I mean, he's terribly unfair to just about everybody in the book, but the basic point is, it seems to me to be correct.
Zachary D. Carter is our guest. He is the author of a new biography called The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. And we are talking about the life and theories of John Maynard Keynes. You mentioned that John Maynard Keynes was married to a Russian ballerina. Interestingly, John Maynard Keynes was also gay. And if we had 2 hours, I would actually ask you about that. But I'm just putting that out there so people know. Because what I really want to spend the remaining minutes of our time on is something that I found profound. And this gets us back to the beginning of World War I, when John Maynard Keynes is really starting to develop, I guess, intellectually, at least his ideas are. And one of the ones that I thought it's technical, but I think important even for our own time now, is that John Maynard Keynes would come to see money, or perhaps more accurately, currency as a tool. Am I right about that? And what does that mean, if I am right?
It, not just a tool, but a tool of the state in particular. He thought that money was sort of a basic tool of governance the same way the military and the way lawmaking are basic tools of governance, that you can't have a government without money. But money is not something that arises kind of out of the social ether where people are just, you know, kind of hanging out and talking and trading, and then you have money develops, and then you have complex state arrangements that develop later. Money instead is something that develops alongside, as a result of the rise of rulership, whether we're talking about the modern nation state or about ancient city states. Money is this ability to create obligations between the government and its people. And that is that's a very abstract idea. It's not just coins with faces on them. So he says, you know, the development of coinage is pretty easy to date. It's sometime in the 8th century BC. We can read about this in Herodotus, and Herodotus basically gets it right. But the development of money and debt and these contracts and obligations between the government and its people, that is much older and goes back to, at least the 4th century BC. And this is an important issue for the way that Keynes conceives about the market, and in particular these ideas about the free market that were very prevalent at the time, which I think are still very prevalent today. Keynes doesn't really believe there's such a thing as a free market that can exist without the state. He thinks that the market is something that is created by the state. And so the capacity to manage this thing is something that can only devolve to the state itself. And the question is not whether the state should manage the economy, but how. And that is a very threatening idea to the economics profession at the time. I think it's still a very threatening idea to the economics profession, even on some of the further left reaches of it. It's a deep challenge to Marxism, for instance. It results in Keynes being able to think about the relationship between money and the people and deficits and the economy in a way that other economists don't. He ultimately becomes concerned with the mobilization of resources themselves rather than debt as a sort of accounting identity. So he stopped looking at the debt as this thing that had to be repaid and started looking at what stuff had to get done in order for problems to be solved. So do we have enough sheep and wheat and labor to feed everybody? Not what money do we owe to who for what reason? Money is always something that is flexible and is used to address social problems. It's not a first principle that must be obeyed beyond the other principles of rulership.
Let's talk more about that, because I want to make this clear. And that is that he saw money, or that he saw currency, as something that we can choose to use in a particular way to deal with particular social issues, rather than we are just beholden to the natural fluctuations of the market itself. Is that accurate?
Yes. I mean, there's a period of his career before the general theory where he is a very open inflationist. He is advocating inflating the currency in order to address social problems, because he believes that inflation will have results that are on net desirable for society, that will fend off social revolution. This is, of course, a horrifying idea to the people in his time, and horrifying to most economists now. But in an important way, it shows his willingness to break with the foundations of the economics profession when he believes that the political necessity is there. We've been talking about debt crises in the United States for at least the last decade, right? There's always somebody, a person of prestige, saying, we have a terrible debt crisis right around the corner. And there's always this specter of sort of the 2008 financial crisis, I think, in our minds when people talk about that. Keynes would have just dismissed this thinking, and he would have said, look, you have crises in society right now. And the goal, the trick is to figure out how to use money in order to solve these crises, not to look at this debt and say, well, things just can't get any better. You have to be creative with how you use these things. In the 1920s, he was talking about creativity in terms of deliberately orchestrating inflation. But, you know, later on, he was talking about he was talking about socializing medicine and creating international systems of exchange, like the Bretton Woods system, which he was very closely involved with negotiating in 1944, and talking about creating a world where people had 15-hour work weeks. He was, I think, in some ways naive and in some ways a little bit utopian, but the basic principle there that money is not a barrier to social progress. It is a tool that can be used to create social progress. That is a kind of inversion of the way I think most economic policymakers think about it, even to this day.
If I am reading too much into this money as a tool, you just let me know. Feel free to knock me down. But it was when I was at this part in your book that I actually had to put the book down for a moment and just sort of think about it. Because it made me even think about our moment today, dealing with this virus, shutting down the economy, government response to it, hearing, you know, Republican leaderships. I'm not trying to make this a partisan issue, but still hearing congressional Republican leadership saying that there's just not enough money to keep aid going to people. We have to open up the country. And I keep thinking back to this, how John Maynard Keynes saw currency as a tool. And again, recognizing it's impossible to exhume the dead to know exactly what they would think, but just from your deep study of John Maynard Keynes, how do you think that would apply to this today? Do you think it's accurate to say we can't keep this aid flowing, these trillions of dollars of aid flowing, because we don't have it? Is that how would see it?
Let me break that apart into 2 points. The first is that for Keynes, everything is a choice. The idea that we can't do it because we're going to run out of money is just not true. Money is a tool. It's not a barrier. So that's not the issue. The issue is what will happen if we spend money on what? How are we going to mobilize our resources? One of the problems that Keynes had, I think would have had with the way that certainly many of his disciples had with the way his ideas were applied after the war, was that they were often used to justify military spending. So Keynes is a pacifist who is opposed to war, despite his involvement in the British Treasury during two world wars. John Kenneth Galbraith, who was a great admirer of Keynes, referred to the type of policymaking that the United States did after World War II as reactionary Keynesianism, because he said, look, we're spending money on war and on tax cuts for wealthy people. That is not the vision that the social vision that we should be pursuing. I don't know if Galbraith had a full understanding of Keynes's deeper social vision. His papers were not as easy to access in the 1950s and 60s as they are now. But clearly Galbraith was aware that you could use these tools for different ends. Today, I don't think Keynes would be worried about the size or the scope of the aid. He'd be worried about the shape and the contour of it. He'd say, what is the problem that we are trying to solve? And then how do we solve it? And Keynes was a brilliant man. I don't want to pretend to know that he was always coming up with these schemes that were designed to kill three or four birds with one stone, right? We'd restore Britain to prosperity. We'd get rid of the war debts. We'd prevent war with Germany, and we'd reestablish a system of international trade. These things, a lot of really big policy goals with a single proposal. In this case, I think he would be looking at the breakdown of the relationship between the U.S. and China. He'd be looking at the public health emergency that is in front of the country right now. And he'd be looking at climate change in particular as serious, clear threats that we know are coming, that we know are in a state of crisis. And so we'd say, well, what can we do about those things? He wouldn't say, well, we can't fix the world because we just can't afford it. You could say, we can't tolerate 25% unemployment in this country. That's just an unacceptable social outcome. So we'll have to figure out something to do about it. Now, what it is that we do, maybe that would involve some inflation. Maybe it wouldn't. It's hard for me to predict his specific policy response. But he would not say, look, we can't afford to solve these problems. In 1942, he wrote a brilliant essay where he said, anything that we can actually do, we can afford. And by that, he meant if we can actually build the buildings, if we can actually feed the people, then the buildings are built and the people are fed. We've succeeded. That's the point. And you know, if you look at sort of the economic dislocations that are happening right now, you know, there is I think there's pretty decent evidence that we're seeing a rise in food prices, right? But it doesn't make sense to talk about the rise in food prices as a result of there being too much government spending or there being, you know, excessively loose monetary policy from the Federal Reserve. We're having a rise in food prices because there's a problem in the food industry, and that because of the virus, the supply chains are all broken down. So it's actually difficult to create the food and bring it to market. And so prices are rising. They're not rising because of the, you know, the federal debt or something like that. So he would look at the way that actual resources were being deployed and what the problems were in specific sectors, which was something that he had to do when he was managing the British war economy in 1914 and then again in World War II.
We're down to our final couple of minutes, but I want to hone in on this, what you said, that he said, anything we can actually do, we can afford. And I imagine there's someone listening saying like, well, wait a minute. No, if you only have $4 or $5 trillion, you can't do anything beyond that point because you don't have it.
The money does not you know, there's no shortage of money, at least when you're off the gold standard. During the gold standard, if you ran out of gold, you could run out of money because you only had so many dollars tied to however much gold you had in your reserves. But after that, the government creates money. That's one of the things that it does. So we won't run out of money. The question is whether we will run out of resources. If you run out of the ability to create the real economic activity that money represents, then you're in trouble. So that's what's happening right now in the meat sector, for instance. We don't have the actual resources to live up to the demand that is required by society, and so prices are rising. But in this moment, what you can afford is what you can do. There isn't some store of assets back there in a vault that says, hey, once this is gone, we're out of this. What you have are people and resources. You have human beings who can go to work. You have wheat. You have sheep and wool and cotton and all of this stuff. And so long as you have the stuff, if you actually have that material, you're not, you know, the things you have to worry about running out of are the stuff, not the money that is supposed to represent how much stuff that you have in these sort of balance sheet and accounting books that exist to keep track of it.
Zachary D. Carter has been our guest. Again, Zachary D. Carter is a senior reporter at the Huffington Post, where he covers Congress, the White House, and economic policy. And he is the author of a new biography that we have been in conversation about. It's called The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. Zach Carter, that was very interesting, and I thank you dearly for taking this time to join us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Mitch.